Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on December 19, 2017. This talk is the fourth of six talks on the Anapanasati Sutta. The Anapanasati Sutta is a discourse from the Buddha on the proper use of mindfulness during Shamatha Vipassana meditation to deepen concentration. The underlying and supportive theme for this sutta is a group of senior monks well established in the heartwood of the Dhamma, the Eightfold Path, and their ability to teach a useful and effective Dhamma. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
This is a sutta where the Buddha is using some senior monks and their well-developed understanding of the heartwood of the Dhamma, meaning the Eightfold Path, and how skillfully they're teaching novices in the Sangha. And then he gets into describing their practice, and in particular their meditation practice, and that really what he's saying throughout this sutta is the mindfulness that they have developed of key understandings that he's taught, but also how, no matter what occurs during meditation, they've learned to simply come back to the sensation of breathing and to use meditation for what the Buddha taught meditation for, to deepen concentration. And then, with the example he's giving in the sutta, as concentration deepens, then we're able to hold in mind — mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind — we're able to hold in mind the important concepts and the overall context of the entire Buddha's teaching. And he really reflects that in this sutta. So last Saturday we talked about establishing the four foundations of mindfulness. And I just want to touch on that briefly, something that I talked about on Saturday, but I don't want to get into that whole teaching, and we'll never get through this. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to deepen concentration and not be distracted by the ordinary functions of the mind, meaning thoughts are going to flow, feelings are going to arise, come back to the sensation of breathing. And the Buddha keeps emphasizing that. And he doesn't touch on every single possibility of what can arise during meditation, but he talks in a general way about, if you find yourself breathing with a long breath, just notice it. If you find yourself with a short breath, notice it. If you find certain feelings or ideas arise during your meditation, notice that you're caught up in that thought or that feeling. Come back to the sensation of breathing. The Buddha's words: whenever a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, satisfying the mind. I will breathe in and breathe out, steadying the mind. I will breathe in and breathe out, releasing the mind. That last line is so important, and notice the progression. First, where we are developing a calm mind by being mindful of the breath, then the mind steadies, it becomes focused. And at that point, we're able to release the mind. Of course, it doesn't mean that we stop thinking. It simply means we're no longer attached to our thoughts. It's one of those lines that people have really gotten way off the rails with, releasing the mind. It just simply means we're not using one thought after the next thought after the next thought to continue a self-referential view of selves, reflecting it in our thoughts. Remember the Nagara Sutta, how the Buddha described that process of being caught up in this self-reflective view rooted in consciousness that is born of ignorance. Here the Buddha's teaching, as we deepen our concentration, and this is three-quarters of the way in the sutta, and have incorporated the framework, the heartwood of the Dhamma, we're able to release the mind. So the focus isn't on releasing the mind. It's as a process of engaging in the heartwood of the Dhamma and a proper meditation practice, we release the mind. It's an occurrence. And the Buddha uses that word, the Pali word. Releasing the mind. There we remain focused on the mind. And the translation, Thanissara Bhikkhu's translation, is, and this is repeated, in and of itself. They remain focused on the mind in and of itself. I've, in most instances, I've substituted or edited that to say free of distraction, because that's exactly what it means, in and of itself. We're just focused on the mind with nothing else distracting me, in and of itself. They remain focused on the mind, free of distraction, ardent, aware, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. I could have added the word with self-reference to the world, because that's exactly what precedes it. Craving and distress arises because we are using the people and events of our lives as a reference to who and what we are. And here the Buddha is teaching that as our concentration deepens and we incorporate the heartwood of the Dhamma, we're able to let go of all self-referential views. We're not taking anything in the world personally, and we're not personalizing anything. We have released the mind, we have released our attachment. You remember how the Buddha described an awakened human being from the perspective of right view, is that person has developed a profound and penetrating understanding of the nature of dukkha. In order to do that, you have to have a penetrating understanding of the three marks of existence. And he described that mind as unbound or released from clinging. And he's referencing that in this sutta. Is that clear here? So the Buddha is really bringing the entire development of an awakened mind and describing it in very similar but also situationally different applications, all pointing back to the need for developing concentration and meditation. The Buddha continues, when this occurs, this monk remains mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while, because of engaging in this process appropriately, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Do you also see the reference to the Four Noble Truths, and specifically the Second Noble Truth? Craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. Putting aside that craving through an appropriately developed meditation practice within the broader framework of the heartwood of the Dhamma, the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, these are really wonderful words here. I do not say that there is a development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful of these simple instructions, or who is not fully aware of these instructions. So there's two conditions that you could not develop the Dhamma practice. You're not holding in mind, or you were never fortunate enough to have been taught these practices. Remember the setting. The Buddha is holding out these senior monks as an example of how to practice and how to teach the Dhamma. Whenever a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to impermanence. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to dispassion. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to cessation. Since sensitive in this term, in this application, means aware of it, mindful of it, mindful that it is occurring, that I have developed this passion. I have the third noble truth is that cessation of dukkha is possible and our contributions to dukkha, and an awakened presentation of the third noble truth is that cessation of dukkha has been experienced. That's how the Buddha describes it. And he's referring again to it here. I will breathe in and breathe out. No more dukkha. And to be mindful of it, to be aware of it. Even if it's just in that moment, even if the next breath that comes, again, he's talking to the whole Sangha here, even if in the next breath a feeling of distress arises, in that previous moment, we've had an experience of the cessation of dukkha, of the cessation of stress, even if it's just in that moment. And it's important to be mindful of it, because that helps us guide our practice within the framework of the Dhamma, within the heartwood of the Dhamma. The Buddha continues. Get away from there. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to relinquishment, letting everything go, letting all self-referential views go. My words. When this occurs, the Buddha's words, on this occasion, the monk remains sensitive to all mental qualities in and of themselves, free of distraction, being mindful of all mental qualities in and of themselves, not distracted by them, being dispassionate about it, relinquishing a need for any mental quality to be different than they are, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Those who see with wisdom and understanding, meaning right view, the relinquishment, the abandoning of craving and distress are those who have established right mindfulness with equanimity, an unwavering mind. When this occurs, this person remains mindful of all mental qualities, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. This is how mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath is appropriately developed, so as to bring the four foundations of mindfulness to their culmination. Again, the four foundations of mindfulness, if you remember that the series of talks we went through over the summer, are first taught to establish mindfulness of the breath, free of distraction, of feelings arising and thoughts arising, and free of the need for the quality of mind to be any different than it is. And then the four foundations continues to teach how to apply that well-concentrated mind, to develop the important aspects of the entire Dhamma, concluding with being able, the four foundations of mind, then lead to the ability to hold in mind the Four Noble Truths. Remember how that concluded? Everybody remembers, sure you do. And now he's referring to that, the four foundations of mindfulness, in the Anapanasati Sutta, using the example of these senior monks, of how they've actually developed that. Okay, that was what I touched on last week. I don't want to go too far tonight, but I'd like to get through the seven factors of awakening in total, but we'll see how far we go. So now the Buddha's teaching, how someone who has developed the heartwood of the Dhamma has incorporated the seven factors of awakening, and these factors of awakening, we've given a few talks on that, are qualities of mind that are to be developed, and once they're developed, they are factors of awakening. Is that clear? So again, these are things to strive for, and they're things to notice as we develop them. And how are the four foundations of mindfulness appropriately developed so as to bring the seven factors of awakening to their culmination? Whenever a monk remains focused on the body, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world, their mindfulness is steady and continuous. Wonderful, isn't it? Having established mindfulness that is steady and continuous, no distractions. When mindfulness is steady and continuous, then mindfulness as a factor for awakening becomes directed. So all the different applications of mindfulness are often good to have. It's good to be mindful of what you're doing. But as far as awakening is, the Buddha taught a very specific application of mindfulness, and that's the mindfulness that is founded in concentration, that is able to hold all the factors of the Eightfold Path in mind as a framework for awakening, and then developing a mind that is steady and continuous within that framework. It's the essence of right view. There's nothing occurring now in my mind to distract me from seeing the world in any other way except through right view, that awakened human being. It's a factor of awakening. Is that clear? Does everybody understand where I'm going and what the purpose of this teaching now is? It's to describe the qualities of an awakened human being. When mindfulness is steady and continuous, then mindfulness as a factor of awakening becomes directed. When mindfulness is steady and continuous, it forms the foundation for culmination of its complete development. Remaining mindful in this way, they examine this quality of mindfulness. Does it mean a deep and distracting analysis? But you're aware of this quality of mind. And I think just about everyone here has, at one time or another, talked about having an experience of a calm and peaceful mind that was somewhat continuous. Now, I'm not talking about it lasted for days or maybe even hours, but we've all had that experience that shows that we're developing the heartwood of the Dhamma. And it's possible to do this, you know, having a mind that's steady and continuous in this way. The Buddha says repeatedly in many different suttas, if it wasn't possible to do this, I wouldn't teach it. When one remains mindful in this way, examining and developing understanding of this quality of mindfulness with discernment, then mindfulness of certain qualities as a factor for awakening arises. This is how right mindfulness is established as a factor or quality, as a quality of awakening. When one who examines and comes to a comprehension of mindfulness as a factor of awakening, then with discernment, investigation of the Dhamma arises. Meaning we have now developed an understanding of the singular importance of appropriate mindfulness in awakening. When investigation of the Dhamma arises in one who examines and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment, then investigation of the Dhamma arises as a factor for awakening, as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. Does everybody understand what I just said?
Say it one more time, please. Maybe two times.
Yes. I'm going to do it this way. When investigation of the Dhamma arises in one who examines and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment with wisdom, with wisdom framed by the Eightfold Path, with discernment, then investigation of the Dhamma arises as a factor for awakening. It becomes aroused. Diane.
What I'm hearing, and that's why I'm asking this, is like if you have a decision to make, or just the daily decisions of your life, what I'm hearing is as decisions arise and you're in the, you know, you're practicing and you're mindful and you're in, you know, practicing the Eightfold Path, then your decisions will be made not on distractions of feelings or delusions or personalities or stuff like that. Am I on the right track?
Yep, that's the essence of the Dhamma is right where you're going. A well-concentrated mind that is able to engage in the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, seeing things from right view, then all those decisions are based on right view. They're based within the framework, the overarching framework of the Four Noble Truths. And so will no longer contribute to more distraction or more unsatisfactory, disappointing experiences for yourself or other people. Unless other people want you to be different than you are, but that, you know, we have no control over that. But specifically, that's what occurs from developing the entire Eightfold Path. What the Buddha's talking about right here is that of holding in mind the importance of developing the heartwood of the Dhamma. And once that is held in mind, that then becomes a factor for awakening. Understanding that there's more than just meditating, or there's more than being distracted by so-called spiritual practice. When it's completely understood that investigation of the Dhamma is a factor of awakening, hopefully what we'll do is investigate the Dhamma and do it in this very well-focused way that the Buddha presents. And then as a consequence of that, when decisions are made, they're made within that proper framework. Is that clear, Helen?
Mm-hmm.
And Diane?
I'm just seeing the importance of focusing, you know, knowing, memorizing, you know, focusing, living within the Eightfold, you know, the whole Eightfold thing.
Yes, yes. So that's the whole point. That's the heartwood of the Dhamma.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you're the distractions that would come in, and I mean, when you're focused on the Eightfold Path, you know, right view, right intention, right life, you know, the whole Megillah, then, and you're saying, I'm hearing the word discernment.
So look,
eight factors allow you to sort of incorporate with discernment, again, in a decision-making setting, what is best for you as well as other people. Does that make
sense? Yes, and so discernment or wisdom is now the, you have developed the heart with the Dhamma. And so wisdom shows you what is unskillful,
yes,
outside of the Dhamma,
yes,
what will only lead to more eye-making and more stress,
yes,
or it helps you remain, again, think about just the words concentration and mindfulness within this framework. It means that you have developed the Eightfold Path as a framework for how you experience your life moment by moment, which means that as your life unfolds, nothing needs to be any different than it is. Your mindfulness is steady and continuous because of the foundation that you've developed within yourself. You've united your, and this, we're going to touch on this a little bit later if I get to it. You've united your body in your mind in your body in reference to what's occurring. Your mind is no longer outside of itself. It's no longer objectified on any false views of how your life should be. And so you're completely mindful within this framework. So again, in a practical way, when something that comes up that might have been distressing or you might have resisted or maybe even exploded over, your mind will remain steady and continuous and you will respond in an appropriate way. It doesn't mean that we'll wake up one morning on a bed of roses and now we're awakened. Dukkha still occurs. But because we have eliminated craving and clinging, we've eliminated craving for things to be different than they are and clinging to the notion that they should be, our minds remain at peace.
This is the embodiment.
This is the embodiment. And I keep, excuse me for putting you on the spot, Dave, but I still go back to an email that David sent a week and a half or so ago now, that the entire Dhamma is in the next breath. And it is when that next breath is well concentrated and arises within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Then it is. That's the type of gentle and refined mindfulness of an awakened human being. And it, one breath follows the next breath without it being self-referential in any way. And look how this directly relates to what I just said, not self-referential in any way. We breathe, we're focused on the breath in and of itself. And so off our cushions, what arises is free of distraction. It arises in and of itself. We're learning to see the discreteness of all phenomena. Which, I don't want to get deep into it, but it contradicts the idea of interdependence and interconnectedness in relation to the Dhamma. We're able to see things discreetly without dispassionately, meaning that those things, because I'm no longer attached to what's arising, and I have no wrong views rooted in ignorance, reflecting off of what's arising, I can simply be at peace with what's arising. And at that point, I can take appropriate and very effective right action, because there's no self-referential ego self involved in it anymore. Do you see how the three marks of existence are, understanding the three marks of existence is what the Buddha is pointing to? You could say that the referring to dukkha is referring to the three marks of existence. It's because of the impermanent nature of all things, a misunderstanding of what constitutes a self, the not-self characteristic, and a misunderstanding of the interaction between these two things, these two elements, that dukkha arises. When we understand that, like Khandana said when he got it during Buddha's first teaching. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. The Buddha said, you got it. You awakened. When we stop the eye-making, when we stop needing things to be any different than they are, dukkha may arise, but we don't need it to be any different because we understand now there's no self there. We don't take it personally. We've interrupted the process rooted in impermanence and ignorance that would give rise to a disappointed self in that moment. We interrupted it through wisdom, through understanding, through the framework of the Eightfold Path. Is that clear? Or did I go off on it?
Being totally responsible.
Yes, but totally responsible in a grim, overdetermined way, in a very gentle way. Why? Because there's no me in it. I don't have a dog in the fight. Sorry, Brecken. It's just what's occurring, and because of an understanding of a profound understanding of impermanence, what's occurring is going to change. So what do I care about it? I mean, care about it in a way that it should be different. And an interesting paradox is when we let go of the need for anything to be different than it is,
what is continuous?
I'm trying to think of the right.
Continuous?
It's a wonderful experience because we're fully involved in our own life. When we think that something needs to be different, meaning I need to have more of it, which usually happens when we have an unconcentrated mind lacking mindfulness, something pleasurable happens, we just want more of it. Or something happens that we'd rather not happen and we don't want to be a part of it. Immediately we're distracted in all different directions from both of those occurrences, from pleasure or aversion. Or when our mind is not well framed within the Eightfold Path, an ongoing ambiguity and indifference to much of our life, you know, that place between wanting something and the aversion, which is where most of our life occurs, and that's where we miss it. Because so we're so caught up on experience that we can't stand that middle way, which is what the Eightfold Path brings us, that middle way. We're able to notice and be a part of our life as our life occurs without the need for it to be any different.
Without having to please anybody from the past or the future?
Yeah, you can't please anybody.
I mean, that's pretty profound.
It is.
You let know of all of the baggage.
This came up a few days ago with an online student. And he said, well, this sounds like a pretty arrogant way of living. And of course, if it's outside of the framework of the Eightfold Path, it is I don't give a rat's behind attitude. But framed by the Eightfold Path in a mind well concentrated, it's the most. Think about the Buddha. The Buddha was the most compassionate human being that ever lived because he understood the nature of human life. And when we can be when we don't have a dog in the fight anymore, then we can be mindfully present with anything that occurs. And if it's appropriate to offer a kind thought or a kind word, it's done with wisdom. It's not done with any type of arrogance at all. It's free of it. Let me continue a little bit. I want to go try to get a little bit further here. This is how investigation of the... Let me go back to that one. When one who examines and comes to a comprehension of mindfulness as a factor of awakening, then with discernment, investigation of the Dhamma arises. You really need to have a level of mindfulness. When investigation of the Dhamma arises in one who examines and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment, with wisdom, then investigation of the Dhamma arises as a factor for awakening. It's now become a real part of your awakening process. This is how investigation of the Dhamma is established as a factor or a quality of awakening. When one who examines and comes to a comprehension of investigation of the Dhamma arising as a factor for awakening with discernment, persevering effort arises. So now the Buddha's taking us through a series of qualities of mind that are developing as a consequence of a well-focused Dhamma practice. As a factor of awakening, persevering effort arises. Another word for that is right effort, the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. Because we're now developing an overall framework of the heart rhythm of Dhamma, right effort, persevering effort, will continue. It's now a factor of our awakening. When persevering effort arises in one who examines, analyzes, and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment, then persevering effort arises as a factor for awakening. It becomes aroused. We're able now to hold these factors in mind. It's not something that moment by moment we're thinking of these different seven factors. They're part of the way we look at ourselves in relation to the world. This is how persevering effort is established as a factor or a quality of awakening. When one whose persevering effort arises, then joyful engagement or rapture, joyful engagement with a Dhamma arises. When joyful engagement with a Dhamma arises and one whose persistence is aroused, then joyful engagement with a Dhamma as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One leads to the next. This is how joyful engagement with the Dhamma is established as a factor or a quality of awakening. When one is joyfully engaged with the Dhamma, the body grows calm and the mind grows calm. Of course, joyful engagement with the Dhamma means that we understand we finally found what we've been looking for. And of course, we are going to be joyfully engaged with that. And because we know, now we're gaining the ability to take true refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha. Of course, our mind and our body calms, doesn't it? We know we're doing what we need to be doing. When one is joyfully engaged with the Dhamma, the body grows calm and the mind grows calm. When the body and mind of a monk is joyfully engaged with the Dhamma, then tranquility as a factor for awakening arises. This is how tranquility is established as a factor or a quality of awakening. This points directly to the importance of developing a meditation practice, shamatha, tranquility, but within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. And so here the Buddha is pointing to he's unifying the tranquil mind that is developed, supporting the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. This is how tranquility is established as a factor of awakening. When one who is tranquil, the mind and body calm, the mind develops concentration. So again, this is not that we don't develop concentration immediately upon beginning a meditation practice, but the profound concentration that's necessary to awaken is developed through engaging in the entire Eightfold Path, the heart root of the Dhamma. When the mind of one who is tranquil and well concentrated, then concentration as a factor of awakening arises. This is how concentration is established as a factor of awakening. Again, it doesn't mean that we don't... It does mean that we're developing concentration in as one factor of the Eightfold Path and developing the entire Eightfold Path, leading to that profound concentration that can hold in mind an awakened quality of mind. Is that clear? Is it? Because that's really what I hope to develop tonight. Okay. My words here. Here the Buddha is bringing the four foundations and the purpose of shamatha vipassana meditation to its ultimate culmination, to establish concentration as the primary purpose for meditation. It is a well-concentrated mind that supports the refined mindfulness necessary to support the integration of the Eightfold Path as the framework for awakening. So again, this is getting towards the end of this particular sutta too. The Buddhist described in very elaborate detail all the things or the many things that can arise during meditation, and now he's concluding it with putting emphasis again on using meditation to deepen concentration to support the entire heart root of the Dhamma.
So to be mindful means so present that when the bully comes in and tries to distract you with various distractions, personally or otherwise, that in mindfulness, in being present now, you don't even hear what's the button pushing. Is that?
Well, you won't react to it. It'll still occur.
You'll hear. They won't.
Yeah, your mind is well concentrated enough to hold in mind. It's not just concentration, but that concentration is necessary. It's such a great question. Thank you. That concentration is necessary to support the framework of the Eightfold Path, and now it's at that point where it's right view. I'm talking about an awakened human being, to simply see what's occurring in a way that you're completely dispassionate about it. You're not taking any of it personally, so your mind doesn't react. And you're able to see things clearly through right view. Right view understands the nature of dukkha arising in the world, but it doesn't react to it anymore because it understands it. Just like you understand a little baby crying, you don't, you know, at least eventually you get to the point where you understand a baby, every time a baby cries doesn't mean you have to react. You understand what's occurring. You've developed an understanding of that part of your life. And so as we awaken, we understand the nature of dukkha in the world. We understand its impermanent nature. We understand that there's no self involved in dukkha. See, the three marks of existence. And so we remain at peace.
Is awakening a continuous process?
Yes, it is, and even upon awakening. Boy, I don't want to get too far into this. Somebody, a student asked me, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't you want to? So there's a quality of mind of an awakened human being that understands the preciousness of that awakened mind, so it will be a mind that is well tended to. So in that sense, it's an ongoing process.
And you continue to develop the focus, the mindfulness, the concentration.
Well, we're getting a little bit away from where I want to talk about tonight. It's just since you no, it's okay. I appreciate the question. It's important. An awakened mind is steady and continuous, like the Buddha describes here. But that quality of mind still needs mindful attention. Needs to be taken care of, like anything else in the world.
Care and feeding.
So even that quality of mind of again, take away all the mystical things we might have thought about and what awakening means. But now that mind, that awakened mind, is able to gently address its own well-being in a steady and continuous way. It knows what to do.
So did the Buddha, after his experiences with Mara, have any more experiences?
I've never come across any of that in any of the suttas. So, and Mara is just a metaphor for a troubled mind. Even the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the sutta that covers the last 90 days of the Buddha's life, including when he was very, very ill, he got food poisoning, and in it, it describes in quite a bit of detail the pain and suffering that he went through, but in a way that you're clear that he understands this is just what's occurring, and even he understands where he got the food poisoning from, and he was very clear, don't even let Kunda know, the cook that made his meal. Don't even let him know because he doesn't want to bring distress to Kunda's mind. So you're still a human being and you feel and experience everything, but your mind is so well concentrated and framed by an understanding of the three marks of existence that you don't react to it anymore. You're able to stay fully present. So when Mara arises, well, in situations where Mara might have arisen, it doesn't because you've gained control of your mind. So your mind doesn't fall into those disturbed mind states. Which is pretty cool, isn't it? Okay. A little bit more. my words, concentration, not personalizing through overemphasis and gross analysis of impermanent phenomena, is the purpose of shamatha vipassana meditation. And it's what the Buddha's teaching here. It can clearly be seen here that the different experiences, the ever-changing qualities of mind that arise during meditation, are not in and of themselves subjects for contemplation, examination, or analysis. It's examining and analyzing the qualities of mind that support awakening, not being distracted by these other things, is the point that I'm trying to make here. It is the present quality of mind established in profound concentration that is the foundation for developing the heartwood of the Dhamma, the Buddha's words. When one whose concentration is established, equanimity arises. When equanimity arises, then equanimity as a factor for awakening arises. This is how equanimity is established as a factor for awakening. My words, a mind well concentrated and established in equanimity remains undisturbed and undistracted by the flow of thoughts and feelings. Resting in equanimity, the purpose and goal of shamatha vipassana meditation is fully developed. This last statement relates to the fourth level of meditative absorption, or the fourth jhana, in the concluding section of the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha describes the culmination of the development of shamatha vipassana meditation arising on four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha's words. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the Four Noble Truths, bringing it all the way back to his very first teaching. Remain mindful of knowing that this is stress, meaning understanding the nature of stress. This is the origination of stress, meaning craving originates and clinging maintains stress, the Second Noble Truth. This is the cessation of stress, and this is the Eightfold Path that leads to the cessation of stress. In this way, one remains mindful of the quality of mind free of distraction internally and externally. We're no longer objectifying our thoughts. We're no longer clinging to the people and events of our lives to describe our life to ourselves. One remains mindful of the phenomena of the origination of qualities of mind and their arising and passing away. There is the knowledge of the maintenance of qualities of mind and their recollection. It goes to that question about what about after awakening. One remains mindful of the qualities of mind to be maintained. There is a knowledge of the maintenance of the qualities of mind and their recollection, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening in and of themselves.
So who you're associating with is pretty important.
Throughout the Buddha's teachings, let me just go read one more paragraph, and then I want to. That's such an important question or comment. So here the Buddha is bringing together the four foundations of mindfulness developed during meditation and remaining mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. Emphasis is on the importance of remaining mindful of the impermanent nature of all phenomena and clinging to qualities of mind, the arising and passing away of all self-referential thoughts and attached mental fabrications. I'm going to stop there. Throughout the Buddha's teachings career, association is just another word for clinging or attachment. The Buddha teaches the importance of wise associations and choosing our associations wisely. To a great extent, what one associates with, whether it's groups of people or other objects or ideas, what one associates with, what one clings to, one is going to determine what one is or will determine their experience. I think I mentioned, I'm not sure if it was here, I had a friend of mine many, many years ago. His name was Riley Reagan. I still remember him. And he was a great talker, a great speaker. And I heard him speak on a speaker on alcoholism and drug addiction. And he almost always concluded with this, placing the importance on if you want to recover from alcoholism and drug addiction, you can't associate with drug addicts and people that are drinking. And he would say this, if you're sitting down in a room and you look to your right and there's a duck, and you look to your left and there's a duck, and you look in front of you and a duck, and you look behind you and there's a duck, it's a pretty damn good chance you're a duck. What you associate with, you're going to become. And that does not mean that we should not have any associate. We shouldn't come in contact with other people. That's just more dukkha. But who we associate with on an ideological level is important. It's something to look for. Getting back to the sutta, what we associate within our thoughts is going to determine our own experience. And if on our meditation practice, we associate analysis of impermanent phenomena arising and passing away, our meditation practice is only going to be further distraction. When we're focused on the mind in and of itself, no matter what occurs, we're going to deepen concentration and we'll gain the ability to hold in mind the heartwood of the Dhamma. So this is a rather long sutta, and I'll still be giving two more talks. I think I'll be concluding on Saturday on it. But it is of primary importance because it teaches how to... It describes how to meditate, but it's not instructions on how to meditate. It describes how to view things and how to engage with what arises. And what the Buddha is teaching is no matter what arises, maintain mindfulness of the sensation of breathing. Be mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath. And when we're mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath in this way, in the right context, being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath is direct training on impermanence. The arising and the passing away of all things. So that's tonight's talk. Thank you. Any questions directly on the talk? Are there? And then we're going to go around the room. And any impressions or anything you'd like to say about the new instructions, I'd like to hear too. So, Matt, good to see you tonight.
John, good to be here. Good to see everybody. Wow. This is just a really hearty sutta. And I don't have much to say about it other than, you know, engaging the proper method, Shamatha Vipassana, in the context of developing the Dhamma, developing the Eightfold Path, cultivates stillness, which is tranquility, which is continuous, which is this abiding calm that we're experiencing after through practice. So this is, you know, the embodiment of the Eightfold Path, the embodiment of the Dhamma, the embodiment of the Buddha's teachings comes through practicing Samatha Vipassana and the rest of the Eightfold Path.
Thank you. And the Thursdays and Saturdays talk, the end of the sutta, if you haven't read it yet, the Buddha describes the culmination of the path. And the culmination of the path is a mind that is steady and continuous and resting in calm and peace, no matter what occurs. Isn't that remarkable? Isn't it what we've been after since we were little kids? I mean, really. I mean, when I was a little kid, I wanted this and I wanted that. But those external things were what I thought I needed to finally have a calm and peaceful mind. It's in letting go of all those things to realize that that calm and peaceful mind is with us moment by moment if we have developed a well-concentrated mind and a way of seeing things from right view. Culmination of the path. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Well, nice to see you. Nice to see everybody. Be in the stream with everyone.
Yeah.
Just what Matt was saying, I mean, it's almost the embodiment of mindfulness. This is, you know, the arising and passing away. You know, allows us to hold in mind, you know, and be empty of ignorance and hold in mind the Four Noble Truths and the heartwood, you know.
That's it.
It's really nice to see those new instructions, because there's just another profound layer to be experienced, the profound right view and this profound sort of discerning mindfulness that we're looking for here. So, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Anapanasati means breath mindfulness. Breath mindfulness. Ram, good to see you tonight.
See you. It's nice to see the whole path, the whole progression laid out.
Yeah.
One step after another after another. And to recognize the glimpses that you've had in that. But I also see I've got more refinement to do in my meditation thing. It seems to be always, oh yeah, it works better. So I may actually have to download your are the new instructions up already?
Or? Yep. Yeah, thank you. I've been wanting to introduce these new instructions for quite a while, maybe even over a year. Mm-hmm. You know, but I wanted to make sure that the context was here so you understand why and you know, what they refer to. So. Mm-hmm. And I think they will help.
And just that beginning statement, now is the time to meditate. Yeah. It's so easy to forget that. time to meditate. And you're already off and going.
Yeah.
No,
and that it puts the focus on whatever occurs. Doesn't matter because I'm meditating. I used to use that a lot when I first started teaching, and I don't know why I stopped using that to begin a meditation session. David, good to see you.
Like I told you before class, I started using the guided meditations. I hadn't used them before, and I find them very helpful. It was a good time for me to hear that last Tuesday and read before, and it's focused my meditation and allowed me to really concentrate much better. So,
yeah.
Greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thank you. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here. I keep coming back to it's all that simple and all that hard. I understand the words, and I know that I can do that. What I have to, the leap that I need to make is that wanting things to be different. You know, for example, you're driving in traffic and someone cuts you off. Well, you wish that they didn't do that.
Yeah.
So I still have that. I wish they didn't do that. But then I can step back and do, okay, well, now I'm behind them. Okay, probably better than having them behind me. And so I can get to that point, but I still have that thought coming through. I wish that didn't happen, or I wish this was different. But I can get to the next step from there. That's one thing that I've been thinking about, and you know, in this holiday season, you can find yourself in a line full of people, and things are taking longer than you wish they would. And maybe the music in that store is really awful, and you wish that it wasn't. But I just go back to that realization of how often can you just spend time just standing in one spot and have nothing more than that required of you. And so then I go back to that space and I kind of chuckle a little at myself, you know, for even like noticing the awful music. But then the other thing that I've been working on is in noticing the arising and the passing of my breath. If I find that my mind has wandered and I bring it back and I say to myself, be aware of the rising and the passing of your breath, then I transition to from the words to just the sound of my breath. And being a sound without words associated to it allows me to step back into that space, less distracted space. So I substitute the sound of an in-breath with the words, and an exhale with the words, and I can slip back into that more concentrated space. Mm-hmm. So those are tools that I'm using now. I was a little distracted by all the more words that are used in the callback, but I'm just going to try to work with that to associate that the words with getting back into that space and see how that works. Because your mind can just go down a wormhole faster than Sharaka, and so it is good to have those callbacks to bring you back. So I'm just going to try to just get to that space faster with those words.
Great. And the callbacks now relate directly to the sutta. Mm-hmm. That's really what I was waiting for, so I had the context to point. And they're on the website, too, just to remind you. Isn't it wonderful to be able to reclaim our mindfulness when we realize when somebody cuts us off?
Mm-hmm.
And though the less than skillful drivers are just part of dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, obviously they don't do it to us, but we often take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of being in the world. And even standing in line, the long lines at Christmas time, that's part of dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
And it's our choice to be in that line, isn't it? I mean, it feels like, I got to buy presents for everybody, so I got to be in this line. But all of those things, being on the street with unskillful drivers is my choice to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes it doesn't seem like that. I got to get the meditation class. But
mm-hmm.
it's all part of just being in the world, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah.
What is wonderful is that you've been able to develop the ability to reclaim your mind.
Mm-hmm. You can catch yourself and put yourself back in the right place.
Yeah,
I'm waiting for the day where I don't even have to catch myself. Yeah.
It's coming. But that's what the sutta talks about too, and all the Buddhist teachings, that it's possible to get to that point. It's not
mm-hmm.
something that's humanly impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely humanly possible to do this. All we have to do is to continue to develop our practice.
Mm-hmm.
All we need is to have that right effort, that persistence.
Mm-hmm.
Kshanti is patient forbearance. We just keep going because we know we've developed that joyful understanding that we know we're doing
mm-hmm.
what has real benefit because we've had the experience of it. It's so important to recognize. Another
mm-hmm.
thing that the sutta points out. Again, remember the Buddha's pointing out this really works. Here's a bunch of maybe a dozen monks that the Buddha's pointing to. These folks did it and they're teaching you.
Mm-hmm.
You're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Greg, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jenna. I saw Mary Beth earlier. She says to say hello to everyone.
Right.
She wanted to be here. Wasn't feeling very good at the last minute.
Oh.
And says hello to everybody. So,
hi, Mary Beth.
And I like the words in the callback. This is the first time I'm hearing anything different. I have not been very good with my practice in the last few days. And I really enjoy the way it points at... So one of the things you added is to specifically say during the callback that this is to strengthen concentration along those lines. And I think that is extremely important, especially
mm-hmm.
for people in earlier stages, because sometimes, even no matter how often you do it, you kind of forget what you're doing. And it really makes it clear. It's like, oh yeah, that's what we're doing here. Especially for people that are still having been with other forms of meditation, and it makes it very clear. Very focused what you're doing and why. But I personally don't meditate with any type of callbacks because sometimes you're really focused and it can kind of jar you out of your focus. So at home, I don't usually. And I think it had something to do with, I took 2 Benadryl earlier because I had a really bad allergic reaction to something. And it was the first time in a long time I was just sitting there focusing on my breath, and it it really jarred me when I heard your voice. I almost forgot what we were doing for a second. And I was like, wow, was that 20 minutes? Oh, wait, no, we do this every 5 minutes. And so I think it's very good for maybe earlier people earlier on in the practice, but if it serves as a distraction, you know, I just, you know, whatever suits the individual, I guess.
Yeah.
But, I think it's very good and would have, or still will be very helpful at times when it really very clear.
Yeah.
So I do. I didn't notice. I'm gonna have to listen to it over again because I'm a little out of it today. But yeah. And as far as the sutta, it's probably, I don't know. It's hard to, you know, rank them, but one of the most important, I mean, they're all the most important ones, I guess, but it's definitely up there.
Yeah, it's in the right context. In other words, it doesn't stand alone, mm-hmm. but it includes direction on how to incorporate the entire heartwood of the Dhamma, how the Buddha starts the sutta. That it is that. The way I've been describing it is there's suttas that are superior suttas. Understanding dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, the Three Marks of Existence, the Not-Self-Characteristic, and Passion, the Buddha's first three discourses in that way. The superior suttas lay out the foundation or the framework for understanding inferior, but not meaning any less important by calling them inferior.
And that's just the heart with it.
Yeah, you have to have the context.
Mm-hmm.
In order to know it properly. If you just heard the Anapanasati Sutta, I don't think there's any way you could understand how to apply it, and that's the problem. It's applied in so many less than skillful ways.
Mm-hmm.
And even the word, I think I said this Tuesday when we first started last Tuesday, the word Anapanasati has more significance in modern Buddhist practice than the actual sutta itself. And so breath mindfulness or breath awareness is now taken on its own kind of thing, and it's so, again, I don't want to go there, but it's important to understand the context of why you're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the words and the callbacks are used to point directly to the sutta. In other words, it is the reason why we're meditating, is to concentrate. It's not for contemplation. It's not for analysis. We're here to increase our concentration by being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, and also to understand the impermanence of all things by being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath. So, again, it's been something I wanted to introduce for a while, but I want to have the context. It's interesting that I've never come across anything where the Buddha did a guided meditation. But again, because those that compiled the Sutta Pitaka, the monks a month after the Buddha's passing, were more concerned about preserving the context, because they understood the context was more important than anything else. And so we have suttas that these words came out of. The Samadhi Sutta, the Sutta on Concentration. The Yogananda Sutta, the Sutta on the importance of Shamatha and Vipassana as part of a meditation practice. The Kamsuka Sutta. The teachings on the Jhana for deepening concentration. And what that experience is like. And then the Satipatthana Sutta and this sutta. It all points to, this is how we meditate. You know, this is the experience. So I'm glad you're here. I hope you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Diane, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
I'm happy. I mean, I'm content and glad I'm here.
I'm glad you're here, too. Thank you. Greg, thank you for proofing this article, too.
I didn't get very far, but...
for doing it.
I'm still looking through it, but you're welcome in advance.
Great, thank you. Mary, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Oh, very good. This is just really fantastic material.
I think so, too.
And the opportunity to deepen the practice, no matter where you are in your development of your practice is very welcome. I appreciate that the emphasis tonight was on the context, right? So again, bringing it back to why we're doing this, what framework we're doing this in. There's so much in the sutta, seven factors, four of this, five of that, you know, all that in there, but it just, it's like a piece of DNA, you know, like it all relates to each other and it's all coming together very nicely. When you're reading it in the moment, it's hard to comprehend it all and walk away from it. But it's really good, and I really appreciate the words like penetrating, it wasn't focus, but effort or something, you know, like that's taking it down to a deeper level of effort around the concentration. And so even the words added to, you know, the callbacks are a reminder of the deepening of what we're trying to do, and not just the emptying of our minds, but actually deepening of concentration. At least that's the effect it's having on me. That for me, like, it's almost a little bit of a wake-up call to take this very seriously, and that the opportunity that's in front of me with some additional effort and priority in my life is not lost on me. It's very, very present. And I also love the words ardent, aware, and mindful are used over and over again, which to me is about, you know, appeals to my desire to work hard, put in a good effort, and to be serious, because you can't be mindful. Mindful isn't just, you know, like a throwaway word. In order to be mindful, you have to have some level of concentration and attention with it. So those words were used over and over again, and I really, you know, that got my attention, that there's always a way to put in a better effort in getting your meditation in, the quality of what you're putting into your meditation. And you're so gentle. You say it in so many different ways, how much you wanted people to read this, which you don't always do. We don't walk away with homework too much, right? But you definitely, as I was listening to Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, over and over again, you definitely were asking people to read it and to prepare maybe a little differently, or maybe I just heard it for the first time. Maybe it's like one of those things you've said many times before, but I just heard it. So I did make every effort to be more prepared, you know, in a more studious way for this one. So, and just words like, you know, joyful engagement, you know, that's something you said, I think, on the first night that David was there. And I thought, you know, that's just, you know, what this is all about. So, anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mary. I'm trying to think how to say this without sounding incredibly self-serving. It's important to me to inspire. I mean, this is the most incredible teaching ever. Yeah. And to be in my position, to be able to hopefully inspire people is not something I take lightly, so it's important. And this is a particular sutta that, again, we learn a lot here, don't we? We learn what we need to learn to develop the Dhamma, but this is a singularly important one in the right context. So I do encourage everybody to make sure you read it and read it again and listen to the talks. And it is going to be, this and the Satipatthana Sutta are going to be part of the next book, which gets a little bit more focused on meditation and mindfulness than becoming Buddha. And it is going to be, both of those suttas are going to be incorporated in our spring retreat. So we'll spend more time on this again, and obviously it'll be something we keep coming back to. So the overall context of this sutta is really what's so appealing to me, is how the Buddha is using it to say, listen to this, because you can do just what these folks did, just what I did, you know, and you can do it now. It's not something, you know, it's not lifetimes in the future. It's right now. Take to the Dhamma and awaken. So thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
And trying to be in that place of acknowledging what arises and letting it fall away. That's, you know, where the practice has to deepen for me. In accepting where things are, and I don't have really control about that. So just being really clear about what it is arising, what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, and then letting it fall. And to use the framework as a way of my response to what arises. So that's, you know, it's all like when you talk about it, I do see it as sort of this visual image. Mary, when you said like it's like DNA, and you know, all the concepts are really built around. I love the metaphor of the heartwood of the Dhamma. I love that idea that. Which is, it's the Eightfold Path, right?
Yeah, that's what the Buddha sees.
Which is
those
everything
words.
Goes back, it's like everything just comes back to that, and then gives it support and context. It's sort of like, remember Clarice Nicholas, you talked about the
taproot?
Yeah, that the when the tree first is planted, the soft center of the tree has to put the taproot down in order for it to get to harden over, but the hardening doesn't have anything to do with the soft center, that heartwood, that place. And I think all the things about the concepts, about the factors and the Eightfold Path is like what supports, gives it like its structure to hold it and be in place. So it's really beautiful.
Thank you. That's, what a beautiful way of putting it. It's all supported on the Eightfold Path. It's the heartwood. Noticing Lorna talked about this too. Most of us don't have too much trouble noticing the arising of the breath, but we hardly notice the passing away. And the passing away is both metaphorical and a practical. It both develops a metaphorical and a practical understanding of the cessation of me, of holding on to views, of impermanence.
Well, it's just interesting, because when you breathe in, you have a sense about, like, I'm thinking, where is it in my body? And when you blow out, there's no, it's gone.
Yeah.
Right? So when you breathe it in, I have it, right? And
you've acquired something. And so there's an ownership of that,
yes.
A very subtle ownership. And so when we don't put the focus on the arising and the passing away, the in-breath and the out-breath, just noticing that can very easily lead to the further establishment of a self even during a meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Buddha is referring to, being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, the arising and the passing away, the impermanence of the breath. And if we can really get that, then the entire Dhamma is in the next breath. And we can get it. You know, it's not something that's beyond us. If we have the right instruction, we develop the right heart with the Dhamma, we get it. Thank you. Liz, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. Thank you for this wonderful teaching. I think everyone has been so profound tonight.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything to add. But thank you.
Thank you for being so profound with that. Brecken? No, nothing.
Brecken had a very good.
What an amazing dog. Jeez. Does that dog have any voice?
Oh, he does.
Okay.
Sure.
A couple times.
Yes, he does.
Lorna?
Identify with, and for me it's the earlier parts where, and I think it's just a brilliant observation from the Buddha that we all reference ourselves from the outside world.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think that's a wonderful observation.
With the reference to the world.
And I can certainly identify
to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on and on and on, and to the point of awakening and preserving awakened mind. And one thing, well, I can't identify to that, obviously. But it's just fascinating that it's just so simple. If you could just drop your avatar, you know, if you just could drop it, and then you would just see the world as it is. It's as simple as that, you know, but very difficult. And then in this meditation, we're asked to look at the three marks of existence. Anatta, the not-self, characteristic, impermanence, and dukkha. We look at anatta in the meditation by trying to not manipulate our breath. And we look at impermanence, the rising and passing away. Sometimes when I'm meditating and when you're tired and not always in the mood, etc., those two things combined is a lot to hold in mind and a lot to try and meditate with. If you were a little tired, for instance, and you can only just like really want to concentrate on one of them, can't manage both of them, which one is the most important, would you say?
Yes.
And then, if we ask them to look at the three marks of existence, I can only see two of them in meditation. Is the dukkha in there subtly or not?
Yes. Dukkha occurs as a consequence of having a human life. Reacting to dukkha occurs because of a misunderstanding of anatta and anicca. Because we have, whether you want to call it inadvertently or subconsciously or ignorantly, established a self in an environment that it can't be established in. Rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, rooted in ignorance of impermanence. During meditation, it's best to be mindful of the impermanence of all things, including a wrong view of self, including dukkha. So to answer your question, I don't know that one is more important than the other, but during meditation, if you can use meditation to deepen your understanding of impermanence, you will gain and develop great insight into the not-self characteristic and resulting dukkha. But if you happen to be sitting in meditation and you notice how you're establishing a self rooted in wrong views, it's a good idea to acknowledge it and come back to the sensation of breathing. Because in that way, you are developing an understanding of the impermanence of even wrong views. Because remember, the three marks of existence applies to all aspects of the Dhamma, including ignorance. If that wasn't so, we couldn't awaken. So be mindful that even wrong views are impermanent. Come back to the sensation of breathing. I think that's enough for tonight. Thank you, Lorna. So it's gift-giving time for most of us. And you hear me say often, the greatest gift I can give myself and to all of this is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. And it really is true. You know, that's we were given these incredible teachings. You know, I know you've heard me say it many times, but to me the most amazing thing in my life is, one, having come across these things, because I was looking in all the wrong places, and then to be able to actually develop them, and again, not that I'm anything special, these are taught for human beings, that they're useful and applicable 2,600 years later, and they're still here. There's been a lot of effort to kind of make sure they weren't around anymore, but they're still here, and we're able to develop it. So, happy holidays, everyone. thank you. We'll finish with the... I'm going to probably have two more talks, so again, I encourage you to read this, read it again and again, and listen to some of the talk, or listen to all the talks. Leave it that way. But I think I'll conclude on Saturday. And I got an idea for what I'd like to do before we start the Truth of Happiness course again on the 2nd. But I'll put it, it's one of those, it's not a well-formed thought yet, but I'll put it in the email. We might do something a little different next Tuesday than we usually do.
Next Tuesday?
The Tuesday after Christmas. Our next Tuesday course.
You're off the next Tuesday.
Right? I'm here. I hope you all are here too. And then the following Tuesday we'll start the Truth of Happiness course again for 12 weeks. So let's finish with metta as we usually do. Find your relaxed meditative posture. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body and notice the impermanence of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class.
Thank you. Thank
peace.
You, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.